I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Mortgage late? Don't wait. If you're struggling with your mortgage, the state of Maryland is offering housing counseling and legal assistance. Maryland's HOPE program can even help you understand the state's mediation law and the Attorney General's National Foreclosure Settlement. Don't wait. Get help today. More information at mdhope.org or at 877-462-7555. Or you can jump on to steinershow.org, and there are banners there. Click on. All the information is there for you. Anthony and I are joined here in studio by three guests and one on the phone.
That's right.
Mike Perry is with us, who was incarcerated for almost 30 years, was released 7 months ago. Glad to have you back with us, and welcome.
Thank you.
Good to have you in studio. Can we get the mics up, please? Alicia is with us. Alicia served been a year.
It's been 6 months.
6 months. Since Alicia's been out, she's heard 7 years in the Maryland Women's Prison in Jessup.
Yes.
Joe Boone joins us by phone. Joe Boone is a man I've known since 1975, when he was serving time in Hagerstown. He was part of my theater company in Hagerstown that Charles Dutton and others were part of. Joe served a number of years in prison. He's been free and clean for a long time. Not the exact number, he'll give it to us. And Joe, welcome. Good to have you with us, brother.
Okay, good. Good to be here.
Jabira Handy's with us. And Jabiria, correct?
Yes, Jabiria.
Jabria?
Yes.
Okay, right, I'm sorry. Jabria Handy is with us. She's a youth advocate at CLIA, Community Law and Action, incarcerated for 11 months, but is a juvenile and adult system. Good to have you with us, Jabria. Welcome.
Thanks.
And you all are with us at 410-319-8888. And let me reiterate what we're going to try to cover today with our guests. And Anthony, we'll both go back and forth here together. And we're very much looking forward to this conversation. This was really inspired because the shows we've done, the conversations in the last week or so, over the Black Rilla family and 13 correctional officers being indicted by federal indictment. And so we have these conversations a lot, but the question really begs itself, what's happening from the inside out? People talk about the gangs inside prisons. So it really does have to kind of consider the question, who runs these places? Is it run really by the gangs and people on the inside? Is it run by the guards? What controls the institution really have? What is the power of gangs there? What do people do all day inside the joint? What's a day like in the life of people? Day and a night like in the life of people who live there? Is there any difference between the men's and the women's prisons? Are they the same now? Some people think that people live in the lap of luxury in prisons, and they have TV, and they have three hots and a cot, and they watch movies, and they have life is okay. What are you complaining about? You committed a crime. You're doing the time. So the question is, who should be in jail and who shouldn't be in jail? What are the alternatives? And we're very curious from our guests, what is their process for transformation and self-transformation, inside and out? And how do you really deal with what has happened to you and what goes on? So that's what we want to try to explore as much as we can with your help at 410-319-8888. We really want to hear you join in on this conversation. Write to us here, steinershow@gmail.com, or join our Facebook pages and write your comments. I'll look at those in a few minutes. So welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Thank you.
So I'm just curious, from all your perspectives, who does really run the place inside? What is the power of these gangs people talk about? Do the guards really have control? Or is no one really in control? Or are they all in control? Joe Boone, let me start with you, since you're on the phone.
Okay. Well, first of all, during the time I was locked down, the gangs weren't as prevalent. But I can only imagine the power they had, because even though there weren't a lot of gangs, the prisoners ran the prisoners. Ran the prisons. I'll give you one good example. I went to the House of Correction for the first time. I talked to a counselor, asked about a job, asked me where I wanted to work. I said I wanted to work in the school system. He said, okay, it's going to take a while, though. So the next day I talked to a guy in there that I knew, and I told him I was trying to get a job in the school system. And the next day, I was working in the school system. So the counselor, like three months later, called me up and said, I'm still working on that job for you. I said, man, I've been working for 3 months.
So that says a lot, Joe. And Mike, not that I'm starting with boys first, but men first, but you've just got out, 7 months ago?
Yes, sir.
So you've seen it from back in the day till now.
Yes.
So pick up where Joe left off. What's your sense of it?
I think it'd be ludicrous to think that anybody other than police run the joint. They got the keys, they got the pepper spray, they got the pick handles, and they operate the doors. You know what I mean? So they can basically lock you down, and nothing is happening once you get locked down. So control is not really the issue. The police had a control.
But
they relinquished certain segments of it to certain segments of the inmate population. And sometimes when they relinquish that control will be abused by various segments.
Alicia?
I don't agree.
Go ahead, please.
Because it's different for women. Like, the thing that I discovered is a lot of the women guards, they try not to have too many men guards in Jessup anymore because of the sex. But the sex still goes on with the women guards because you have a lot of women guards that are lesbians. You have a lot of young people that are now incarcerated with a lot of time. And they don't feel as though they have anything to lose because they think that it's okay and it's a popular thing to be sitting in prison and you're 21 years old, you're 18 years old with 60 years. And they run around like it's a big playground because it hasn't really sunk into them that this is your life. You made a choice that's affecting the rest of your life. And a lot of the guards that are now in the women's correctional facility, they're foreign officers, and they're afraid.
Foreign officers? What do you mean?
Like Africans. You have a lot of Africans that's now a very large population of the correctional officers in MCIW. So, for one, they don't all understand English. And then you have these young children that are bullying. They are bullying. You know, you have a system that took a work release unit from women that was housed somewhere completely separate and put it into a maximum security prison. And then you wonder why you have drugs and everything else coming inside of the prison. And you're talking about officers that don't always do the best searches. And these people are bringing the stuff in and you're selling it. Prison. It's just like being out on Green Mountain 25th. You could be out there, it's inside the prison, getting as high as you could on the street.
So I'm going to come back to what you just raised and also what the other guests just raised. And Bria, let me get your perspective on this.
So put it like this. If you had a person out on the street and they worked at this certain job, you got a job connection. Mm-hmm. So if you know a certain CO that work in that building mm-hmm. and you want something to come in the jail, there you go. So I, for one, think that the prisoners, the detainees, or whatever you want to call them, they do run the jail system mm-hmm. because you got certain people that work in there, aunts, uncles, or friends, or what have you, that bring you track in there, that bring you food, uptown food in there.
Did you say crack? What did you say? What's the first thing you said?
No, track. Like your hair.
Your hair, okay. I thought I heard that. I wasn't sure. Gotcha. I'm sorry, baby. Go ahead.
Yeah, so anything you want, you can get as long as you have that connection with that person. If they feel frightened of you, and a lot of times you have these young women or like young correctional officers coming in there. Mm-hmm. So they feel frightened by the person that they see every day. You know, they sitting in there, they don't know how much time they going to get, and you have this correctional officer that's going uptown every day. So, hey, look, I'm going to let you know this. I probably have a murder charge, and I could do anything I want to you in here. So what you going to do is you're going to bring me what I ask you. And if you don't, I can have somebody get you, you know, in the city, for mm-hmm. real, because I got that type of connection. So long as you got the connection, you could do what you want.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have some questions about the
industry. So, Mike, I want to ask you, and then I want all of our guests to respond to this idea. I found it fascinating that you were in for a very long time,
yes.
but you were very clear that you believe that the police, ultimately, at the end of the day, the correctional officers, have the power.
Absolutely.
Is it? Do you believe that because of the fact that you said they have the key? They ultimately shut the door. Or do you see a psychological? Because I think with the news over the last week, people have been – I was stunned by the number of callers to my show on Friday. Uh-huh. People really want to talk about what is going on inside those prisons. And they have this idea that gang life, which we hear about from our police department outside, gangs control neighborhoods, gangs shut down neighborhoods, gang control the violence and murder that we see upticking in our city is because of gangs. So I think it goes to reason that people really do believe, whether we're talking about the women's facility or the men's facility, that those gangs that we fear on the street are, in fact, in charge in the institution. Did you see that? You said there's certain segments. But I'm very curious if the perception that we have of the influence of these gang leaders and these inmates is a perception, or is it really the reality that everybody keeps talking about?
Now, you have to appreciate the fact that, folks gravitate towards the sensational.
Of course.
Now, this is sensational right now. You know what I mean? It sells papers and everything else. A lot of times when the sensational appears, truth will go out the door. You know, and what's not really truth will run in and take its place. You know, I come in 75, went home 95, came back in 04, just recently went home. And the culture of prison has changed dramatically. You know what I mean? It's changed from rehabilitation to retribution, lock them up and throw away the keys. You know, I got a segment of friends that are lifers, man, that haven't had the opportunity to make parole since 1993. Mm-hmm. Eddie Conway, Timmy Poole, Soldier, Gerald Dent, you know what I mean? Tubby. Man, these brothers deserved an opportunity to come home. But factored into this culture change is dudes like this that have name recognition. And when you talk about gangs calling shots, what about these old dudes that have laid a lick down since the 70s? What kind of power do they have with respect to gangs? Like, I was jive all right in my day. You know, I wasn't in no gang, but I wielded a certain amount of authority just by virtue of being respected. So when you talk about gangs having a whole lot of power, yeah, I'm not buying into that completely.
So there is, what you would say, that there is a division inside the walls between older heads and the young guys coming in or young women coming in.
And the way they do business.
Now, older guys have breached that. I mean, not breached that. It's been a disconnect. But programs like Friend of a Friend and other programs come back and connect. You know what I mean? They get young guys, gang members, the whosoever, and mentor them. And this causes a semblance of non-violence, but aberrant behavior and negative violent things dissipate for a season, you know what I mean? Which is why we've been banned, because you can't dissipate violence so much in prison when you're talking about building more up Western Maryland and more down the Eastern Shore and more someplace else, man, because the bottom line is it's about dollars, you know? That white supremacy and that oppression is the root, you know? When you until you deal with that root, you're going to have all kinds of stuff that's going to represent, and we're going to call it a gang. Gang is a euphemism for anything that the feds want to call that comes against what they're doing.
So, I mean, okay, Anthony, you wanted to hear from everybody on this.
Okay, well, for me, like,
let me get close to the mic, too.
Okay, as far as the women go, they have a gang unit inside of the facility to try to maintain the structure of the gangs. And they have a specific set of correctional officers that these gang members can go to at any given time, because they're trying to minimize the amount of violence that are happening, because you're talking about people that will jump on you at any given time. They took the locks out because they was taking the locks, beating people. One girl got killed by a group of gang members inside the facility. And they had to try to figure out a way to let her family know what had happened. And they don't want to be responsible and be accountable for what's actually going on. You know, and then they have a mentoring program with the lifers there. And I can agree with you on that. You have a lot of women lifers that are at the Maryland Correctional Facility for Women that fell under the old guidelines when they were sentenced. But because of the changing in the guidelines of the prison system, and now life is supposed to be life, a lot of them are not getting the opportunities that they need to come back out and re-enter society. Because it's a lot of women. I have one of my best friends is down there, and this is her 25th year in Jessup, Maryland. She's watched the same people come and go. And that takes a toll on your mind when you're watching the same people come and go like this is a revolving door, and you're not getting that one opportunity. She has a master's degree. They have a college program down there. But how can you continue to educate these people if they're never going to have the opportunity to come out and use it?
Joe, you want to jump in on this? Cause
I want to say something, touch on something the brother said, Mike, which I agree with, because I know there are a lot of guys in there with life, and like I say, life means life now. But you know, I think it's it's wrong to discount even the possibility of a person growing, of a person becoming something other than when he came in there, and just saying, okay, that's it. You're never going to be nothing, and we're going to keep you here the rest of your life. You know, I think that's immoral. But that being said, something else he said about gangs, it is what the feds define it as. I mean, some of the laws that are terrorism-related, end up going after drug traffickers. Gangs, I mean, what is a gang? I'm not saying they're not gangs. They are gangs, okay, no doubt about that. But it does end up being what the feds say it is, which is about pretty much everything else in our society. So, and another thing, if we're not, I'm not in opposition to his position, because he said, like he said, the guards do have the control, but he clarified it, and he said that they do relinquish some powers to the inmates. It makes it easier for them, but ultimately they determine whether you're going out or not. But you know, as far as the door is locked, some people you know, don't care. Mm-hmm. I was in the hole one time for like 4 months. They opened the doors, everybody was rushing out, and they came to me and said, why are you still in here? I said, I'm reading. Close my door back. You know, I couldn't go home. You know, they said, you're going in the hole. Okay, that's another part of the jail. Mm-hmm. Big deal. And when you got people with life and with no possibility of parole, I mean, you can just imagine what that does to their thought process. You know, your values change. A lot of things change when you go in the Fed joint. They have it very clear on your papers, and you got life. It's an expiration date upon death, and the finality of that. I mean, it's got to do something to you.
Before we go to the phones here, Joe, was all your time done state, or did you do Fed as well?
I did Fed as well. The last one was Fed.
Let's go to the phones here. 410-319-8888. Audio, you're on the air. Audio, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
You're on the air.
Okay, fine. I just want to say that it was mentioned about the gangs and, you know, who pretty much controls either the officers or the gangs and things of that nature. It's a balance. It goes both ways. You got the gangs who, they don't control anything for real. I mean, most gangs, they do what they do as far as trying to manipulate, trying to control. But it's up to the officers to maintain and to do what they do as far as doing what's necessary to maintain control, to run the institution administratively, correctionally, and things of this nature. But the inmates can only do what the officers allow them to do, and vice versa, because I've been in a situation, you know, for 14 and a half years recently, where though I heard an administrator say she thanked the inmates and said, you know, you all run the jail. We thank you all for running the jail, because we go out, we want to go out with the same amount of holes we came in with. Meaning that they don't want no other holes, no stabbings with them. So they are grateful that they're leaving out and they don't have any extra holes. So I'm saying that to say that on the same token, you got, you know, other people who want to do what they do as far as the corruption and bringing things in, things of that nature. But those are the decisions that they're making. So you cannot blame inmates for that, you know, gangs and all that. They do what they do, but also the correctional officers, they do what they do, whether it's legal or illegal. So, but the thing is that, you know, we got to keep it balanced. We got to keep it balanced and know that, you know, there's corruption going on both sides. And it's unfortunate, but the reality is, it is what it is. And, you know, you can't just blame one side and not you know, look at both sides.
What you contributed here, audio, is important, I think, because that was part of what we're trying to get to here. So the question is, I mean, and that's also what Mike Perry, I think you were talking to when you first opened up here in this program, which is that when you look at the overall system, the gangs are not in charge. The overall system, the system's in charge of your lives and everything else.
Correct.
They're supposed to be in charge. Right. And so, but the thing is that, and let me see if I'm right or wrong about this, that the parts of the world that corrections officers in the system take their hands away from and leave to the inmates themselves, that in some ways is a different kind of hell because they have no control over it. Mm-hmm. That's the part that seems to me for many people to be to misunderstood this. I mean, the power is to lock people up. The power is to not grant parole. The power is to say you're in the hole. Mm-hmm. The power is to say you're not going to get your commissary. But what happens to you on the ground, on the tier, in the yard is a different proposition.
Exactly. Because you find that a lot of times they will try to appease you based upon not wanting trouble from you, you know. And a lot of times you're looking at inmates that are in there and they're trying to do what they're trying to do so that they can maintain their time and get out. And then you sitting here and you catering to this group of people. But when these group of people need help, they're being turned away. And it's bringing about animosity because you have some people on this end who's trying to do the right thing and want they're learning their lesson. And then you have these people who don't care. They don't care because at the end of the day, if you put them on lock, okay, you put me on lock. All you're doing is locking me up. But I'm still on the grounds. I still got access because you got inmates who are working the floor on a lock. You got inmates who are overseeing psych patients, people with serious mental problems, and they call it evaluation. You're sitting there on suicide watch. So each inmate has a shift where you sit in front of a door where an inmate might be having serious mental problems, beating on a door, banging on a door, and they are sitting there. You got inmates who are doing jobs that aren't theirs to be done.
We have to get a real break. When we come back, I'm going to ask our guests what you think can reform that system, what could change it from your perspective, and explore even more deeply about your own lives and what transformed yourselves. 410-319-8888. We'll be right back. Anthony and I will be right back to continue our conversation. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And we are here with Mike Perry, who is incarcerated for almost 30 years, released 7 months ago. Alicia, who spent 7 years and has been out about a year from the Women's Cut, right? And Jessup. Joe Boone, who has served a number of sentences, both federal and state, who's been out for a long time and is a counselor and an actor and works with people who need help in his home, where he moved back to in Virginia. Jabria Handy's with us. Youth advocate for CLIA, which is Community Law and Action. She was incarcerated for 11 months as a juvenile in an adult prison. 410-319-8888 is the number here. We'll get back to the phone sheet in a minute. But, I mean, so where we left off. So I'm curious just for our listeners to hear from you all. And let me start with Jabria, Mike. If we could just describe for people what day-to-day existence is like in reality for you all when you were doing time. What was it like to be stuck there? What was it like to be incarcerated? What was your life in your daily life, Jabria?
Well, as a 17-year-old mixed with a whole bunch of adults and you don't know what's going to happen to you, I was scared. Like, I literally almost pooped my pants when they was taking me through the halls. The first experience that I ever had was showering with a grown woman who was like high to death. Like, she was literally leaning in the shower.
High in the joint. High.
She's like leaning in the shower. And I, like, you know, kind of was in the corner showering myself. But it's, I mean, it's real complicated for you to have such a charge, whatever your charge may be, and you're not having no family support, or you're not having, like, any support, period, and not having no type of rehabilitation. Or sometimes they would cut education off for us because maybe we were bad in the dorm. So that is something that they would, you know, punish us with. Oh, you're not going to go to school because you didn't clean up the dorm. Or, you know, I've seen a lot of things happen as far as this man being bloody and stabbed up in the hallway. And I don't know if he died or not, but the COs just was like, oh, well, look away. No, I'm not looking away, because what if somebody run up to me and do the same thing to me?
So how did you see a man be on the women's side?
Well, it was on the men's side. So in a juvenile dorm, which is G dorm, you have to travel through a tunnel in order to get to the trailer. So you have to go through the men's side.
Oh, I see.
In order to get to through the trailer, which they always supposed to put on lockdown, and they never put on lockdown. So you got men staring at you, and you don't know if they like rapists or nothing like that. So it's like a very scary experience for especially a young person to experience that. You have a lot of mental things going on, and especially being in, you know, I guess y'all would call it the hole, but we just was call it lockdown for 36 days and not see one person and get a shower once a week. And you have like a bathroom stall of a walkway back and forth, and you see all the writings that people had put on the walk, been here for, you know, 106 days, or I miss my family and stuff like that. And you wonder how long you going to be here and if you ever going to see your family again.
Joe Boone.
Hey. Day-to-day. Day-to-day, well, I can only speak for me because it varies from individual to individual. And then the dynamic of the institution that you're in changes. But what I used to do was have something to do all day in the evening. I got into programs where I could get out of the cell, be going to programs. I played basketball every day. I worked in the school. I read. I wrote. And it not only made the time go faster or seem to go faster, but it also was giving me a foundation that I could build on when I got out. But it's a routine, and some people like get transferred from joint to joint, break up time, make it seem like going faster. I didn't. I was always trying to get to a lesser security level. That was my objective, as well as personal growth. But basically, it's a routine. You set your own routine, and sometimes it's disrupted. You know, if it's a lockdown or something like that, it's disrupted. But you get out, you pick it up again. I didn't spend a lot of time dwelling on negativity because, you know, I knew I was breaking the law, and I knew it was a chance that I was going to get caught, and I knew it was an even better chance that I was going to prison. So it didn't come as a surprise to me as it seemed to some people. So I just had a routine that would make time go past fast for me, and that would help me to grow. And that's basically how I did, you know, all of my bits.
Alicia.
For me, my sentence was 12 years. And I really, in the beginning, didn't know how I was going to make it through that. Because I knew, like, I knew I did what I did. And I got what I got. So I didn't go into the institution with false pretenses. Like, I'm innocent, I'm going to fight this. No, I took the deal because I knew I could have got a lot more time for my crime. My crime was with a deadly weapon. And, you know, by me being an addict, because I've used drugs for over 30 years, and I wasn't really able to deal with the issues that actually caused my addiction and caused my behavior. It wasn't until I spent half my time at Patuxent Institution and started getting therapeutic value is when my outlook started to change. So my 7 years was actually broke down between Patuxent and MCIW. My last year was spent at the Baltimore Pre-Release Unit for Women, which they wind up closing down. And the therapy is what started my process to know that I didn't have to be that away. And I didn't have to live that life. Because that 7 years was hard for me, being away from my family. My mother died while I was incarcerated. A lot of things, you think a lot when you're in prison. You find things to keep you busy. Like, I worked and I read and I took classes and I helped people and I did the things that I should have been able to do when I was out on the street. But due to my bad choices and some unfortunate circumstances in my life, I chose to do the things that I'd done. And by me being an addict, it caused some really harsh behaviors in my life. And the person that I am as an addict is not the person I am with the values and the morals that I was instilled in as a child. You know, in a process, I just realized that watching people from day to day, I didn't want to be 50 years old sitting in Jessup. I didn't want to be 50 years old standing on a corner talking about who got it. You know, it's more to me than that. Yeah. And a lot of people have this misconception that because you're in prison that you're a bad person. And that's not the truth. There's a lot of good people that just made very poor choices. And a lot of time I feel as though people judge people based upon what they hear versus upon sitting down, listening to a person and talking to a person, getting to know that person, understanding where they come from. You have a large, very large percentage of the women that's at the Maryland Correctional Institution for Women that come from abusive situations. A very large population of the women that are there for murder are there because they were molested as children and they got into bad relationships and they were abused as wives or they was abused as girlfriends and they protected themselves. And a lot of times for me, it helped me to understand that we don't understand why women stay. But once you get a chance to talk to those women and understand that some of them didn't see any way out. So they stayed until they got tired because everybody has a breaking point. But if you only look at the outside of a person or what you hear about a person, you never get to really know that person or why they chose the way that they chose. So for me, it was a very great learning experience. I learned a lot about other people as well as myself. And it enables me to be able to not judge people based upon what I hear.
Mike Perry.
Now, I think they had a clue about this correction back in the day. You know, when I first went in, it was a multitude of programs. You know, you had Lifestyle, SANS, JC's, you had Project Turnabout. You had a multitude of things. You had a boxing team. You had varsity football, tackle, and flag football. You visited various joints and played to see who was going to be the champion of DOC. You know, we would go down to Cut 1 year and play for the championship, and they'd come up to the new jail or the old jail to play the following year. You know, it wasn't rocket science, you know. An idle mind is a devil's workshop. But they threw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, the stuff that was worked, it was some few kinks, dudes like myself that were on work release. We ended up robbing banks and do some other stuff, and that minimized the programming that they really wanted to take place. Folks on the street got tired of guys in prison having the advantage of going to college, and they couldn't even pay for their own sons and daughters to go to college, you know, which is kind of understandable from their perspective, you know. But nevertheless, it played havoc in the Division of Corrections. So now you have young guys. I feel for these young guys. They're between a rock and a hard place in the DOC. They come in. They fit the stereotype of what a gang member is supposed to look like so they can arbitrarily get tagged. They never had a father image in their family, so they gravitate to some love from a man. You know what I mean? I'm talking about the real type of love. I ain't talking about no hanky-panky or nothing.
I'm talking about sexual love.
Yeah, I'm talking about some love where you have a dude that you look up to and say, man, I can talk to this guy. You know what I mean? In the absence of that, they gravitate towards gangs. Now, I don't condone violence or nothing like that, but I do condone a young dude trying to find some love in a guy and gravitating towards him or trying to find some relationship with some dudes that he can find on his own peer level. I definitely condone that. You know what I mean? But it's absent in the Division of Corrections. You know, all you see is insensitivity, you know, lock them up, throw away the key. But But you got to understand that in a nation that you got 2.5 million prisoners who pay, who the society says they pay $30,000 or $35,000 a year, then you're talking about a $60 billion industry, mm-hmm. this prison industrial complex. You're talking about a piece of pie that everybody's trying to buy it into. So it's not advantageous for them to cease gangs, so to speak. You know, the COINTELPRO that worked back in the day, they now call this thing Intel. But it's the exact same thing. Stamp them, keep track of them when they go on the street and while they're in here, and make their bits as difficult as possible. Because, like I said, the idle mind is the devil's workshop. They're in the cell about 14, 15 hours a day. You know, they don't have anything to do. Most of them don't have reading skills that enhances them, enables them to really sit back and read a George Jackson book mm-hmm. or, you know, this new Jim Crow thing that this girl came out with, Michelle Alexander, you know what I mean? Right. That I don't necessarily subscribe to, but that's for a different show. Mm-hmm. But they're in these cells, you know, so it's not rocket science. If you get programs like the Friend of a Friend, other programs to come back in, because see what happens, these programs are small, but the good work that they do spreads vicariously through the whole institution, yes. because they go back on tears. They go back in the courtyard. They work in the gym. They teach guys how to box. A young guy will come up there and say, man, can you show me how to do this? And while he's learning how to box, he learns some coping skills such as conflict resolution, how to minimize damage when he encounters things like that on the tier. You know what I mean? I mean, it's not rocket science, but somebody needs to hit the DOC upside the head, starting with Gary Maynard, and say, man, wake up and smell the coffee.
Anthony, please. And then we'll go try to get to the phone show. I apologize. I get into the phones fast enough. Brother Bay, I'm sorry we didn't get to you, but there's so much to say here. So many people are saying so much, but Anthony.
A very quick question, and all of you can jump in and answer. How do we begin to change the perception? When I talk to people about programs in prison, I was talking to a police officer just the other day, and he said, Anthony, people don't care about what's going on in prison.
They don't.
As long as it does not come outside those walls.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And he said all of this interest in the black guerrilla family and sex with prison guards, correctional officers, he said it's just salacious. It would be no different than people are interested in who, you know, Michael Jackson's life or the Kardashians' life. He said that's the interest, he said, but when it comes to programs, when it comes to rehabilitation, he said the American public no longer cares about rehabilitating prisoners. What they want is people to be locked away, have less comfort, I think is the word he used. Mm-hmm. And he was real clear. And then the more I thought about it, I'm thinking, well, Anthony, you're the kind of person that does care about rehabilitation. So that's why it's in the forefront of your mind. How do we begin? As you said, we can't hit Secretary Maynard in the head. But how do we begin to have a broader political and social conversation about people inside our facilities who hopefully will come back to our homes, our families, and our communities so it makes sense to invest in teaching them skills that help them cope, teaching them skills where they break the cycle of addiction and abuse. How do we begin that conversation? Because it does seem America's reached a tipping point with their care and their interest in what's happening with inmates.
Now, what you're doing here is a step in the right direction. Right. But we need to get some of these churches, too.
Right.
Some of these church leaders who have a disdain for prisoners, and if it's not a member of their congregation, they wouldn't give you a bus pass when you came home or a clothing voucher or nothing else. You know what I mean? But the Bible says in Psalm 102 that God looked down from heaven because he heard the groaning of the prisoners and those destined to die. You know what I mean? God ain't happy about this stuff that's going on with respect to prisoners. Something's going to happen. You know, somebody go wake up and sound their alarm for these guys because there's too many good dudes spending decades and decades and decades behind these barbed wire fences and these prison walls, and some of them, sorry to speak, may end up dying in prison, man. So I ain't going to never stop crying out for these dudes, man.
Right. Jabria?
So, from my perspective, you have young advocates like myself that go out into the communities and we speak on this issue and let them know that we still have good youth in our community just because they supposedly did this crime, because not all the youth are getting sent to prisons. It's only 10% of them getting sent to the prisons. So just because they supposedly did this crime doesn't mean that they're no good. Like, we can just put them away and just forget about them. So we have a lot of youth programs such as Community Law in Action, Baltimore Algebra Project, you know, Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle,
yes,
and places like that that go out and talk to the communities and let them know that we're here, we're standing for, all we need is support. We need the community support. We need, you know, you adult supporters to say, oh, I care about our children, and we should do something about this. So what you're doing, amen, and what we're doing is kind of the same thing of letting the community know that we still out here, we doing good, and we want to do better, but we just not getting a chance. So
I hear you.
Joe, were you trying to say something?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's like you said earlier, they don't care. I mean, all those programs that the brother was talking about, it wasn't like by accident that they disappeared.
That's right.
You know, it's okay, why would you try to put a person in a position to stay out on the street when you can make more money off them in prison?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
You know, and there are resources, because some of the guys, like he was talking about, the guys with life, I mean, they weren't so disenchanted, they could be a resource to help young
That's
people
right.
too.
Yes.
If they would use them, and then that would also give them an opportunity to show their growth and change.
Amen.
But it's not about that. You know, it's like lock them up, make money off of them. I was reading an article about NFL joints. It was one of the towns, I don't think it was Lewisburg, one of them. They said when they first put the prison there, it was a village of like 700 people. Now, because of that prison and other prisons, it's like, you know, 50,000 people there. Mm. You know, there's mm-hmm. money in it. Why do you think so many people want to build private prisons? You know, they want to privatize prisons because there's a profit. There's nobody, no businessman in the world that you know want to get engaged in something that they can't make money from. So it has to be money made from prison. I mean, that's pretty obvious. But, you know, I this might be off topic, but I don't, you know, if you send somebody to a prison sentence, after a certain point, it becomes counterproductive. You know, if you send somebody, you know, like with life, that starts out, if you say no parole, that starts out being counterproductive. But somebody once said, and I'll stop on this, how can you punish a man whose remorse is already greater than his misdeed?
Yes.
You know, after a certain point, it gets counterproductive.
So I mean, one of the things that may be, I'm going to go to the phones here and try to get some calls in before we end the hour, and I invite you all to come back in maybe about a month or less to pick up about what you all think, where we should go from here.
Amen.
What your ideas are about reforming the system and how men and women transform themselves and how you all transform yourselves at different stages of your life. But let's go to the phones. Brother Bay, you're on the air. You there, Brother Bay?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Peace and blessings, everyone. Let me just, the reason that we're having this discussion is because of the manipulation of the Black guerrilla family. Let me give you the history. George Jackson created that in California, you understand me, to bring Black prisoners, Black males together so that they can minimize racism, elitism in prison. And one of the things that when I was coming up, I'm 65, I've been in every institution state of Maryland, I heard one of the brothers, and I want to call their name, they talked about people like Eddie Conway, Tuffy, who got double life, to come up under me in the streets, Turtle Wells, Brandon Evans, we can go on. And I appreciate your panel, because it's personal. What is missing in the process, Department of Correction need to change its name because it infers that it corrects people's behavior. Right now, I'm a residential criminologist, and Anthony knows the work that we do. Their philosophy primarily is punitive, incapacitation, deterrence, et cetera, et cetera. None of those dynamics. Retribution, rehabilitation is a myth. If you know words, re means after the fact. People have to be rehabilitated before. When we was coming up, they didn't call them gangs. Those who are old enough to know, they call them cliques, crews, and posses, and whatever else that I may be forgetting. But what I want to say is that there's a way to change when the people was talking about having programs. I think the guy whose name we talked about Beverly Nair. If I call that name here, no, we used to come in as the prison renewal committee. And we used to engage those folks. And what I'm hearing is that when we talk about reentry, the epitome of reentry from my perspective was Brother Malcolm. People like us, when we went in the institution, we didn't serve the time. The time served us. It became a university because we used our mind. We didn't pump ball. We didn't play ball, pump weights, and chase. I'll say it like this. If you know what it means, you know what it means. Agaphase. We was about our business, and we came out better people. And the work that we do, the folks that are not on Brother Bear Fossil, the reason that we do the work that we do, because it's therapeutic for us, and we never forgot where we come from. And it is an industry, and we don't have that kind of conversation.
Right. Brother Bear, we don't have much time left. I can't, so I got to come back to the studio here, because we're just about out of time. And I hear what you're saying, and I think that one of the things we want to do is, we've done before, we had a show about the Bastards of the Party, which is a documentary that really gives you the history of BGF and how the revolutionary movement was kind of torn asunder and turned into the gang world and all the rest, and George Jackson and all the rest of that. And I was there the day he was shot outside the prison. So, I mean, that's a part of the story we have to tell, and we will come back to that. And I think that it'd be good if we had a round table here with some people who run the system, to kind of create some, if it's possible, to create a dialogue with people who with y'all and people who actually run the system. See if we can get to a place where we can talk about a different way of doing this, because Brother Bay is right. It should be perhaps called the Department of Incarceration, not the Department of Corrections, the DOI, as opposed to DOC. Do you have a thought before we go? We've got about 2 minutes left.
No, I think you're on to something, Mark. I think this is a brilliant dialogue. And, of course, it doesn't shock me that the Steiner Show would bring together this panel to force us to look at ourselves, because I think ultimately we all have power. It's a question of whether or not we abdicate that power. As Brother Perry said, we also have the power to make a difference. The question is, will we reach inside and make a difference? Or will we continue to live within our own walls and say, what's happening to the people inside has no impact on me? Well, you're just lying to yourself. You really are lying to yourself. So I think it's a great conversation.
And I just want to thank all the guests who came in today. You all were just magnificent, what you had to share with us. Jabria Handy, I know you've been through a lot. And it was great to have you in here. I hope you'll come back again.
Thanks.
And Brother Mike Perry, good to meet you.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming
in
here.
Nice to meet you too, Mark. You got some cards.
And Alicia, just a pleasure to finally meet you at the phone call. Look forward to having you back as well.
Yes.
And my dear friend Joe Boone, thank you, man.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you for having the interest to come into the prisons and work with us when we were there on the theater project and to talk about other things too. That made a difference to a lot of people.
Thank you, man. Okay. And then if I hadn't done that, you and I wouldn't be friends.
Right. That's right.
And thank my dear brother Anthony McCarthy for co-hosting on Mondays.
Thank you, Mark. Great
to have
you
here. And reminder, listen to Anthony McCarthy this Friday at 5:00. But soon, starting May 13th, you'll be hearing Anthony Monday through Friday at 5 p.m. here. And be hearing me at 9 a.m. here, Monday through Friday, and we'll be switching gears and doing a lot of interesting stuff. And Michelle Martin is telling me more. We'll be coming on 11 o'clock.
Some programming changes. Exciting.
And it's going to be very interesting and exciting here. So thank you all for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Mark Gunnery, and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our intern is Lila Warshaw. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast this show, and any of our other shows, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. Also, information about our guests and their work will be there as well, so please visit our website, steinershow.org. Right now, it's time to stay tuned for Keep It Moving with Marsha Reeves Jews. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.